Okay, this is part two of Social Empowerment and the Economy. I think we probably can go for about a half hour more till 7:15, since we started. I mean, we started more late than that, but I think. Okay, so let's turn to the equal asset market socialism model. John Romer's. There are a number of you at various questions and sources of skepticism. Nobody was wildly enthusiastic about, although some people had some positive things to say about John Romer's contrived scheme. Just so you know the historical context for this, this was written in the early 1990s at the time when it was clear that the Soviet Union was going to be transformed, and that this statist command and control, command economy was going to be dismantled. And the issue was, would it be dismantled in the direction of a reconstructed capitalism, or would there be a way of actually creating a market socialism? The general criticism of the Soviet Union as an economic structure centered around the pathologies of central planning. So the main criticisms that were raised from a strictly economic point of view, not from the broader human rights and democracy point of view, centered around pathologies linked to central planning. Some people argued that the that was not laughter about central planning. Laughter about other matters to not be recorded on the internet.
Funny.
So in response to the pathologies of central planning, which were, I think, unequivocal, everybody acknowledged them, some people argued that the real problem was that the central planning mechanism was authoritarian, bureaucratic, and occurred in a kind of politically restrictive environment, and that what was needed was a democratic participatory planning of some sort, that democratizing the Soviet Union would be the solution to the pathologies of planning. Other people argued, no, that you can democratize the political system as much as you want, as profoundly and in whatever participatory ways you could imagine, and still comprehensive central planning simply won't work, and in a mature economy will create perverse effects. And so you have to dismantle the comprehensive planning model. Romer then intervened into this discussion, along with many other people, to say, yes, we have to get rid of the attempt at comprehensive central planning. That won't work. But we don't have to do so by reintroducing private capital markets, private property in the ordinary sense. We can create a peculiar kind of form, which he calls market socialism. And then he proposes a particular mechanism, a particular institutional device, by which you could do so in a way that would reproduce the socialist character of the market socialist configuration. There are other models of market socialism besides Romer's. Some people proposed cooperative ownership, for example. So firms are owned cooperatively by the workers employed within them, but the firms interact with each other on a market basis, buying and selling to each other in an ordinary, decentralized market way. There are arguments for and against each of the different designs for market socialism. But Romer's, I think, is in some ways the most interesting of the ones that I'm familiar with. Certainly it's the cleverest. I mean, he has some very interesting ideas in it. And I thought is worthwhile in terms of imagining how you might be able to have robust markets along with an egalitarian distribution of assets. And how much of what we dislike about capitalist markets would be eliminated if you accomplish that. So that's the agenda and the setting for it. Ido, Molly, Rodolfo, Wes, and Guillaume and Todd all had things to say about equal asset market socialism. So if any of you want to start the discussion.
So I just have kind of a question. Is Romer kind of implying that financial markets would not exist in this framework, or would is this exist in parallel to the equal asset?
You could have financial markets that lent, that did loans, just ordinary bank loans. That is, a bank can loan dollars to a firm, which the firm uses to buy capital and pays back the loan. People can borrow money from a bank to buy a house. You can have mortgages. What you don't have is an ordinary market in equity, in the actual ownership of the firm. So banks, when they make loans, don't gain any property rights in the firm. They can't, they don't, when they make a loan, they're not on the board of directors. They don't hire and fire the CEOs. They're just making a loan. So you'd have financial markets and loans. He basically doesn't address that question. So I think you would definitely have financial markets and loans. And banks charge interest rates for those loans.
But firms can redeem their coupons for dollars at the central bank.
Right.
So that's essentially a form of.
But the central bank will not own any, won't have any shares as a result.
That's a way of retiring.
That's a way of the.
It's a mechanism for liquidating your assets so that you can use them for investment instead of, because there's otherwise no.
Transformation
of coupon
too. It would be something like IPO, isn't that would be.
Right.
Does there have to be some?
Well, not just initial public offering of stocks, but any large corporation can raise capital in two different ways. They can borrow it from banks, basically, or bonds, sell bonds, whatever. It's essentially the same as borrowing from a bank. Or they can issue new shares as a way of raising capital. So it's not just an initial public offer. Corporations can issue new shares at other times too as a way of raising capital. When they do so, they're inviting people to become owners of the firm. So the number of shares that a corporation has is not fixed at the time they initially.
I thought coupons can only be transformed into dollars from. So dollars can purchase coupons?
No. You issue new shares, and then people buy them with coupons. This corporation says we're going to have a public offer of 1 million new shares. If a lot of people are interested in this firm, mutual funds might be interested. So what they will do is. Sell some of the shares they have in order to get coupons, because people have coupons, which they get. Young adults get coupons. You get coupons if you sell your stocks before you buy new stocks, and so people will have coupons to buy these new shares. The firm then gets coupons, because that's the shares are denominated in coupons. But those coupons are useless to a firm. You can't buy a new turbine with a firm with coupons. They have to convert them to dollars to actually buy the new means of production, and that's what the central bank does.
Yeah. The important restriction is just that people can't redeem coupons for dollars.
Right.
In essence, anybody.
You need coupons. You need an initial set of coupons in order to be able to like turn that coupons into like a venture capital. So I guess how are new businesses or new corporations going to be started unless you already have a wealth of coupons, come from a previous wealth of money?
So there's everybody gets, when you turn whatever age is the adult definition for this, you get issued a mass of coupons by the collective equal to your per capita share of the total asset value of the economy, of the coupon economy. So you can decide what the per capita wealth of this economy is. And when you become an adult, you get this pot of coupons, so all young adults do, which you then can invest as you wish by buying shares in corporations. Most people, particularly when they first enter this process will give their coupons to a mutual fund, which will then buy stocks for you and some give you some diversified portfolio. So they'll do the same thing that most employees do who have 401k accounts. You know, they devote a certain amount of their income to buying stocks, in effect, when you have a 401k, but they don't usually actually pick stocks. They just put their money in some mutual fund that does the stock buying. So mutual funds will do most of the work here, presumably, just like they do today for ordinary people. The difference is that everybody will have the same amount of resources to devote to this, and the resources they get can only be devoted to this. So the mutual funds are going to do the management. Now, startups are another matter. In the book, but not in the article that John wrote about this, in the original book, he has a discussion about how to deal with startups. So if you just, you know, in your garage want to start up a business, you just start it up the way you do in a regular capitalist economy. And then what happens is if a business becomes a certain size, it has to convert to coupons. So you have a prohibition against privately owned firms getting above a certain quite modest size. And once it's at that size, you have an IPO in which you sell stocks, and other people then become the owners of the firm in this form of coupon ownership. So that and it's a political matter what that size is. So you'd have to decide. This would be part of the hybrid quality of the system. You decide that venture capital and private initiative is actually a pretty good thing. It encourages people to take risks and to take risks in ways that enable them to try out things and fail, but they're only failing, risking their own dollar money. When your firm gets to a certain size, you then are forced to have an IPO in which you lose control over the firm. That is, it becomes then a coupon-based firm. You turn those coupons from that IPO into dollars, and you're rich. So there will be some people who will get dollar rich from, but only from being entrepreneurs that start up firms. And you set that limit low enough that they don't become super rich. They just become sort of rich.
And there, I mean, I don't know, I guess this is one of the, it's like you would never know until such a system existed. But like, given the profit-making nature of capital, could you, I mean, I could see some circumstances under which, like, you know, you have a firm that, or a business that starts up, and then right before they get to the point where they're too big, they somehow spawn like another firm or something, just so that that regulation becomes its, like, I don't know, it's right. Just like an external, but like if there is some huge amount of profit or some amount of profit that can be made, I think given the market system, it seems like that would lend itself to, like, I don't know, these weird sorts of,
I think you're probably right that any set of rules that we can imagine that would govern this would allow for people to game the system.
Right.
There'd be ways to do it, and that would mean that it would be an iterated process by which you would create counter rules to block the most egregious of these ways.
Which is how the market works now.
Right. So there, we have a good example now is, before we had stock markets, somebody might have said, you know, this just isn't going to work because insider trading is going to clearly mean that insiders are going to make all the profits and everybody else are going to be suckers. Right. And indeed, that's true, unless you have rules against insider trading, which turn out to be hard to enforce,
right,
but not impossible. And they keep the insider trading problem down, they keep it under, you know, dampened. So it's much less bad than it would be in the absence of such rules. It contains the problem but doesn't eliminate it. And it, obviously, from the point of view of ordinary capitalist economies, it contains it sufficiently well that stock markets work pretty well as instruments for investment and whatever. And occasionally they fall apart, but you know they're not as bad as you might have predicted because of that problem and other sources of fraud. So there would certainly be strategies that people would have. But, you know, those kinds of issues, almost any system that we can imagine, you know, even if you're, even if you believe in statist socialism, so the state's going to own everything, most people think, well, small restaurants shouldn't be owned by the state. Now, the idea of the Soviet-style cafeterias that were all state-run were just dreadful. And the idea that in Cuba today, where there are all these small little restaurants in people's basements, they're great, and they're much better than the state restaurants. And most people think, what's the big deal? What's wrong with, you know, a family starting a little restaurant and making extra money as a result, and the food's good.
Petit bourgeois.
Right, so there's a lot of what makes cities livable is the petty bourgeoisie, right? So, and you know, most workers prefer to have those kinds of restaurants and cafes available, and so, but then immediately, as soon as you allow them, you have the problem is, well, what happens if they're really successful? They get bigger. What do you do? Well, you create some rules about it. And those rules will always have holes in them. The question is, are the holes such a big problem that it unravels the system or not?
So is there anything that would stop this kind of thing from working with the system, sort of articulating with a separate real utopian design where you had sort of some form of worker ownership of, you know, the enterprises in which they actually work? I mean, is there like a some percent rule where if you had, you know, let's say we have a separate real utopian design which says there's no juries involved.
There it is, waiting for the jury.
Here's my random spontaneous real utopia for the evening. You have 51% ownership rule which says that firms of a certain size have to be 51% owned by
the juries.
But by the workers in the actual enterprises. Right? Because we think for purposes of worker autonomy and things like that, we think that this is a good rule. Is there any reason why that would not work with equal asset market socialism if the only shares that could be traded were the other 49%? I mean, there would be constraints on the abilities of the shareholders, the coupon holders, to, you know, intervene in management of the firms and so on.
So, I assume that if we had carte blanche to simply create systems, right, that we're not under any path-dependent constraints, that there's all sorts of variants that one might imagine that would be improvements over any pure system. So my general assumption is that a plurality of forms combined in different ways is likely to be better than a single system across all contexts. And it's clearly the case that we, from a real utopian, democratic, egalitarian point of view, we believe that a great deal of what goes on within a work setting should be under the control of the people in that work setting. And so we believe that's true for universities and it's true for factories. The question is, what exactly should be under their control and what not? Well, pollution rules shouldn't be, because anything that has a negative externality should be controlled by all the people affected, not just by the people producing the pollution. Which suggests that the real principle is not that workers should control their workplaces, but that people should control their destinies, in which case controlling your workplaces is one instance of that, because it's one setting where your life is shaped. And but the broader notion is of a sort of stakeholder control. The people who have a stake in some process because they're affected by it should have some role in governance of those processes. A convenient way to do that for certain types of things like pollution is to have the state do it. That is to have a set of government regulations around pollution. But then possibly having local environmental councils that are involved in the monitoring and the implementation of those rules, rather than having it all done through centralized bureaucracies. You know, there's lots of different ways to do it. Now, back to your point about co-ops and asset ownership, the argument in favor of an equal asset ownership system is that the profits generated by a complex interdependent economy should be equally shared among all people, not just the people who happen to be in the capital-intensive sectors where the biggest profits are being generated. So that whether you're working in a daycare center or in a high-tech firm should not govern your right to a flow of part of the social surplus. And if you have the workers in a firm own that firm, it gives them a privileged relationship to the surplus which they're producing, as opposed to the surplus being something that's collectively owned and should be distributed collectively. The asset ownership mechanism that Romer proposes is really just an equal distribution of the surplus mechanism. It's basically distributing the surplus equally to all people, with the added twist that of the belief that having a market in shares will provide a more efficient way of giving. It's like having price signals around the efficiency and profitability of firms that would be missing if they were all simply state enterprises and the surplus was simply distributed. So it's allowing for some level of competition to improve on the efficiency problems. It avoids central planning of all the details of every firm. The firms are autonomous units. But it does say that the workers in the firm don't have any special claims on the surplus that they produce. So the Romer system is consistent with the governance structure within the firm that has works councils and democratic participation over the control over the labor process and what goes on inside of the firm. So you can have that without having co-ops. You could have worker-run firms. The University of Wisconsin has professor-run curriculum and professor-run admissions and all that, and the basic rules of the university without it being a professorial co-op. We don't own the university. We can't divest ourselves of the university and pocket the proceeds. So we have no property rights in the university, but we do have governance rights in the university. And that could be true in Romer systems. Workers and factories could have governance rights over whatever are the relevant domains of their governance without being co-ops, that is, without having property rights in the assets of the firm.
But there was some discussion here of, voting on boards of directors and possibly other aspects of governance. So there's some, unless it means that the coupon literally is only an entitlement to a flow of dividends, if it's something like a stock,
yeah, it's meant
then there's some ownership.
Right, so it's meant to provide people. It's meant to provide agencies that have an interest in the flow of dividends from that firm, and therefore are prepared to monitor its performance, and to provide various kinds of directions towards investments and other properties. But that can be combined with a lot of internal democratic governance as well. Sort of the equivalence of the Board of Regents and the democratic control within the university.
But access to the surplus in a particular firm doesn't necessarily equate to any kind of power in that firm, correct? And then, in the end, if people are trading coupons for the... And I understand that, if you have mutual funds or you can invest in socially responsible companies, but in the end, it seems that something in a stock market like that sets up profit as motivation rather than. So I'm actually having trouble understanding why it fits into your criteria and why it fits into this book, because maybe that's me, maybe that's my misunderstanding of how this would run, but. I just see that the profit is still...
Ignore it.
Yeah, and that's from us.
I think...
I hope they're not still there.
We can say, connect some for the day.
The argument for why this fits into the real utopian imagination, why it's part of the conversation, is that it dramatically erodes capitalist power, because there are no longer privately held concentrations of wealth. So the destruction of capitalist power, the egalitarianness of the asset ownership. Mm-hmm. Now it's whoever it is calling me here, but I'm not going to answer it. I just want to be sure. Oh, it's Marcia, so. So I just have to. I just have to wait till I'm. So in the existing context, there are some huge wealth holders in corporations, mm-hmm, who have concentrated power by virtue of their wealth, and have particular interests with respect to what Romer calls public bads. And the combination of having interests in public bads and power by virtue of their wealth enables them to act on those public bads in favor of them.
Okay.
The completely diffused ownership of the assets in corporations through this coupon market, in which the fact that you can't convert your coupons into dollars maintains the relative egalitarianism of it. Nobody is going to be able to accumulate large fortunes of coupon shares, means that there will not be concentrations of capitalist wealth. And that weakens capitalist power within the hybrid of capitalism, socialism, and statism. So if part of the thing which makes possible movement on those pathways is weakening the capitalist pole, that is, diffusing that capitalist power so there aren't capitalist agents capable of deploying that power, that creates more possibilities for the other. That's the public bads kind of argument.
But there is...
The argument for including, because I have the same question, should be that besides doing that, it improves the system in some way, because I can accept that it would reduce the power of the wealthy owner of this company. But at the same time, I don't see that this mechanism would improve the society. I mean, for example, in the public bad discussion, or the exploitation discussion, or the democracy.
So on the exploitation discussion, it means that everybody gets a flow of dividends, which will be especially an especially significant part of the income of those who are least advantaged within labor markets. So it's egalitarian with respect to the distribution. You're drastically reducing the amount of capital income of the rich and drastically increasing the amount, the flow of capital income, that is income derived from capital, for the poor. It's on average 15% of income, capital income, but it'll be 40% increase in the income of the poor and a 60% decline in the income of the rich.
Where did the figure 15% come
Romer, I mean, I don't remember.
And isn't that essentially kind of like a Fordist argument? Like, then you give more money to those people at the bottom, right? So now that they can buy more things and use your money and...
Well, but whatever else you think, I think, I mean, whatever else your position is, having a less unequal distribution of income is better, I think.
Unless it reinforces capitalism.
Well,
if you
feel that, that's equivalent to saying it's a good thing that if we can't overthrow capitalism, it's still a good thing that the poor are poor and not less poor.
But I
because
no, it's,
they'll be
I
more
think
unhappy
it's very different
capitalism.
When you're talking about cash surplus and resources. I think those are very different things. So I don't want to necessarily give poor people in this country more money. I want to make sure they have basic resources, education, access to.
But you're not
in
favor of raising their wages?
Well, of course I would
because
we live in a capitalist system.
Yeah, but
system.
We do.
Absolutely.
Right.
But it's not because I want them to have more. It's not because I want them to have more buying power. It's because I want them to have basic necessities taken care of.
Well,
and if in this system, what they need to get those is money, it's like, okay, well, yeah, let's raise our wages. But if we're thinking real utopian-like...
Well, but in a real...
Someone else stop.
No. In a real utopian world, there's going to be a surplus
right.
that's left over after all new investments and whatever. do we want the social surplus that's not being allocated for specific investments to be distributed more or less equally to people or not? And if we do, this is one way of distributing the net social surplus, that's what's left over after we've allocated it to other purposes, mm-hmm. to all people on a more or less equal basis.
But I don't think that's inherent in this type of program, because you still have different firms or different mutual funds earning different amounts of money. So the equal redistribution is not inherent, I don't think, in this program.
I was wanting to understand if in a real utopia interest is a given, because it sounds like it is. Because even if you try to diminish the people with money by trying to equalize who gets what, when you have a concept of interest always at play, there's always going to be a mechanism for people to stratify, you know, basically separate themselves because their ability to loan money and make money off of the loan. You know, I mean, I understand there's always, you can't borrow money for free, but at the same time, in a real utopia, there should be at least recognition that continual interest, it seems like it plays into what you call that negative externality for people who aren't able to do it, you know, at the same rate that others are able to do it. But if I'm able to lend money continually to people and set the interest rate on receiving my, you know, my repayment, then I'm always going to be, you know, separating myself from people who aren't. So, please.
But I think this system limits your ability to make money off of money. Because you can't, if you have money, you can't invest that in businesses. You can only invest coupons in businesses. So if you have money, all you can do is start something in your garage.
By real estate.
Oh, you can lend money.
Yeah, you can lend or you can.
But we said earlier there are capital markets, right? So you could start a bank and lend.
Yeah, but if you start a bank, it's a company and you have a stock.
This is not a comprehensive design for all institutional spheres. So I think there is a problem in the banking sector in this model, because a high earner in the labor market who has a lot of discretionary income can put that money into a bank or buy bonds with it, in effect, because bonds are just loans, and receive an interest from those loans. And so that's an inegalitarian feature. This model does not itself address the question of inequalities in the labor market, although arguably it would make that problem easier to tackle politically, because it would establish the general principle of there being an egalitarian logic of at least some of the system of distribution around assets, and therefore the extension of that to labor markets might be facilitated. But this is really just dealing with one kind of problem. We have private property and means of production. State ownership of all means of production with centralized planning doesn't work. We need to have some kind of more decentralized system. We could imagine co-ops as being the solution. All firms are owned by their workers. But that has a lot of disadvantages, too. It means that workers have, in a sense, all their assets in a non-diversified portfolio. You have a co-op that runs into difficulty, it falls apart, well, then workers lose all their assets. So to have co-ops as being the only mechanism can be itself not such a great thing if the co-ops involve real assets. I don't mean babysitting co-ops, which don't have a lot of assets. You're not putting all your eggs in one basket there, so to speak. So if you believe that you can have centralized planning, you can do indirect planning of various sorts. You know, you can set incentives and create sectoral plans, but you can't really have comprehensive plans where you specify what everybody's going to produce. You need decentralized decisions. Co-ops are not a good universal model. They might work in some cases and not others. We want to have some measure of competition between firms and some way of establishing whether they're doing well or badly, so that there's a better information environment for learning and for correction. Well, if you give all that sort of thing, then Romer's proposing an institutional device which accomplishes a lot of that and undermines concentrated forms of capitalist power, therefore reduces this public debts dynamic, and creates, I think, greater space for more democratic and socially empowered forms than to work. If this were the only thing changed in the economy, so if this is a standalone proposal with nothing else changing, first of all, it would be an utter fantasy. That is, it's a kind of unreal utopia, because I think, impossible to imagine a historical circumstance in which you could expropriate all the private owners of large corporations and redistribute their shares equally to everybody. If you had the power to do that, you could do a hell of a lot more. And if you could do that, why would you stop at that? Why would you also have a basic income and a large social economy with public subsidies? You know, you do a lot of other things. Mm-hmm. So if you could actually institute this, you would institute a variety of other changes which would interface with it.
Eric? Yeah. I think we've said a few times that, you know, alone this is not a sufficient institutional change to meet our expectations of an egalitarian society. But I think the underlying issue that we're almost getting at is the question of whether an initial egalitarian distribution of resources or goods or whatever it is that we're talking about, once given over to market exchange, would remain egalitarian or would reproduce unequal distribution. And I think we don't really have a good answer to that, except in very general terms. We know that Romer's scheme would greatly reduce inequality, but we know that it would preserve some level of differential returns. The question is, what degree of differential returns are possible within a person's lifetime? How much unequal distribution will that produce? And are we okay with that? And I think those are impossible questions to answer. And right. I think that might be part of...
You could get the domination of the risk-seeking over the risk-averse and this kind of thing, right? I mean, that's, you know, the prediction that this would equalize income is a prediction, and there's other... I mean...
Rodolfo.
But it's not the same all the cases that we are discussing, because I think in this chapter the universal income is much more feasible, and you can at least you can imagine the benefits that it will bring to society right away when you read it. With the markets as the equal asset, it didn't happen to me. I was trying to think, okay. And while I was reading, I was imagining more the worst thing that it would bring rather than the good things that it would bring. So,
something about Romer invites that from other Marxists.
And in a suggestion would be not putting that as a first case. I was really mad at that. I didn't even write comments about the other two because I was so mad. But then the universal income, I mean, it was a proposal of a political party in Argentina. I mean,
right.
It didn't win election, but in case it had won a democratic election, I think it could have worked and improved the life of the majority of workers and poor.
I think here's my feeling about the Romer thing. There are a variety of proposals for the sort of basic reordering of the overall property relations at the kind of macro level for the system as a whole. Michael Albert's Paracon, this participatory economics, which is comprehensive participatory planning, is another such model. Romer's is one that relies heavily on markets and competition among firms, but tries to neutralize some of the negative effects by preventing the private accumulation of wealth as a consequence of that competition. Comprehensive central planning is another form. The anarchist vision of a cooperative federations is a fourth. So there are these different models for how you could organize the overall structure of an economy. I don't find any of them completely compelling. I don't find the Paracon model seems to me unworkable. I mean, the Oscar Wilde nightmare of socialism taking up too many evenings just becomes kind of impossible if you imagine all the different.
Have a little person waiting.
Get to your little person. I don't want little people to throw fists. Yeah, it's almost 7:30, so we should. So, you know, each of these, I can give you good arguments for why none of these work. And that's the reason why. Here you should that.
Invoke it.
There is a hook. There is a hook there. That yeah. We have a basic problem with the relationship between the glass on these things and the seats. As you can see, the ones at the bottom tend to get smashed. But you know, so one of the arguments against socialism is that there is no satisfactory, clear-cut model for the overall macro structure of socialist economies. That there are lots of things which seem to have potentials, but in practice, they have difficulties. The reason why I think that Romer's thing is worth being part of the discussion is not because I think it's likely to be the optimal model for this kind of macro organization, but it could be that in some kind of complex configuration where you are combining these different sorts of mechanisms, that some form of equal asset ownership capitalism combined with social economy, co-ops, and statist socialism might in fact be the best mix. And this is the set of mechanisms that have been proposed for having something that could be called market socialism that would have at least some plausibility to it. My reaction when people give sharp criticisms of it, I ask, well, what's the alternative? And people invoke comprehensive planning. I'd like to see how it would work. And the problem. A lot of these things. This was my reaction to Ricardo's comments. I don't know if all of you saw those because they came in late, which was. So you might read my comments on Ricardo's his intervention came in early. It's just that I didn't see it because it wasn't an attachment. So my comments on his interrogation are at the end, but he had sent it in early in any case. So he basically says, why not comprehensive planning? Now, what's the big deal? Why don't we just have comprehensive planning and make it democratic? I think that underestimates the complexity problem in actually being able to organize the vast array of inputs and outputs needed for a complex economy unless you have vaguely relevant prices to assess what the trade-offs are between different uses of resources. And it's hard to see how you would get vaguely relevant prices without some kind of market mechanism, at least as part of the process. Price formation is a big problem, and if you have to do it all by the calculus of input-output matrices and kind of production functions without those interacting with the preferences in supply and demand and priorities of people, which is what markets do. Markets take production functions of the technical compositions of commodities and then subject them to people's actual preferences, which gives you feedback as to whether things are properly priced. Unless you have some kind of market interface with this, it's just very hard to see how planning could even begin to take place.
You have to take this design to leave some space for the market? I mean, because we could accept that. I mean, there should be some market, like in Cuba now, or some, I guess, I didn't study the history of Soviet Union, but I guess there was some kind of market.
Well, you don't want clandestine markets in the cracks of the system.
But the previous part of my argument was, even if you accept some space for the market, and some more, there could be some more realistic design, because with this example you get lots of rejection that puts together the market with this design, that maybe it's not the case.
The points of discussion we had today too in your office, and I think in determining price, but I think there's a different way to determine price that reflects value that doesn't reflect a market determined value. Maybe we can discuss that at a later time, but I think there's something different in that that we should explore.
There have been attempts. So Marxist economists have made attempts to create systems of relative prices just on the basis of the technical information about the composition of production. And I think that they are all intractably problematic. That they just, and it's not just because of mathematical problems, that may be part of it as well, but the heterogeneity of the inputs to production, the heterogeneity of the labor inputs, the heterogeneity of all these other inputs, and the non-linearities in the way in which they generate the value of outcome by how they're put together, not just their additive effects, I think makes it impossible to derive the value of something just on the basis of a technical inventory of inputs, unless you know what the trade-offs, the opportunity costs essentially of those inputs are. And that's what simply using their prices would be. Now, of course, actual prices in the market are always distortions. They're never pure prices. They're not produced under competitive conditions with perfect information. So the actual prices that markets give you are not the prices that would be these optimal prices. But they may not deviate for a whole economy. The deviations may be relatively small, so that knowing the costs of things in terms of what their prices, the prices of all the inputs, may be good enough to be able to do a pretty good planning process on a market economy. And this is arguing for the need for democratic planning of the market rather than democratic planning versus the market. Mm-hmm. Now, whether you need a market in shares for this to work, that's an additional question. But I'm not sure what the alternative would be. It's one way to imagine it working, is that you have shares, and then you just try to be sure that they don't get accumulated. So this Romer is allowing a market in shares. If we want to eliminate a market in shares, then how do we do it? If it's all co-ops.
Yeah, because the share assumes that these are big companies
right.
making a lot of profit, right?
Right.
So yeah. Maybe if those are state directed and the rest is the market,
that's
a different model.
Yeah, so you could have all big corporations or state firms, but is that actually going to be less subject to problems that, to have these giant corporations run by central?
Isn't the problem there is one about incentives, right? Not about
right.
planning, right? Because, in theory, you could have a bunch of state-owned firms that are without decentralized planning system. The argument against that is that managers wouldn't have incentives to be efficient and things like that. But there's nothing intrinsically about being state-owned in terms of planning, right?
The question is, do we want the allocation of the investment resources into a firm to be dictated by a planning office or by some other mechanism, right? So the purpose of having firms competing with each other, in which having these stock markets as one aspect of firms competing with each other, is that it provides better signals for which firms are doing well and which firms are doing badly than if we don't have firms competing with each other.
I think all the arguments about planning, the problem of planning, are about relative prices of inputs to production, right? And this is about the relative prices of assets on some sort of ownership market. It's sort of two different things. And I sort of accept the critiques of centralized planning, but that doesn't that's kind of neither here nor there when it comes to talking about market socialism, because it's not, you don't actually determining the prices here of anything that is actually an input into the production process. There's still, this just assumes that there are markets for all the commodities and intermediate.
It preserves the market system of allocation of goods and prices, and markets as a mechanism for producing prices, which are signals and information for decision making in the society. But what it does is it then takes the unequal result of that and dampens the effect, the production of inequality as a result of that. But we don't know to what degree it dampens it, and you know it's.
I think given that it's 7:30, we have to. I mean, this is definitely an unresolved domain within our broader agenda.
Maybe you should move that part towards the end of the chapter. Because we have